Welcome to Earthbeat and Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. In this show, you will learn how to slash your carbon emissions while gaining energy independence, hearing from people who do it now. As climate peak oil and the economy crash into a perfect storm, get ready to keep going. Get off fossil fuels and get off the grid.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Do you dream of getting out of corporate control and away from polluted food and city smog? I'm Alex Smith. Let's travel that path with Cam Mather. About 14 years ago, Cam and his family of four left a city in Canada, heading back to the land, to homestead. But they don't live in a dark teepee or a shed. The Mathers are working out super low-carbon lifestyles with all the conveniences of home. Cam Mather, it's good to have you here on Radio EcoShock and for Earthbeat.
Great to be here, Alex.
How did you get from the dream to actually buying your property?
It took about 5 years. We had a number of points on our list that we were looking for, you know, hope to have the land so it could be certified organic. We hope to have some water on the land. And, you know, 14 or 15 years ago, it was tough to get solar in a home, but yet we managed to find a home that was off the electricity grid that was powered by photovoltaic panels. I guess the main key for us, though, really was the fact that for many years we had been very careful savers, had managed to pay off our mortgage, and that's one of the ways that we were actually able to make the move to the country was by paying off our mortgage and having some security that way so that we could pay cash for our property, not have a mortgage payment we had to make, and it gave us a little more wiggle room to make the move.
And one thing I found interesting about your adventure is a lot of people talk about community, they want to build community, but you actually didn't want to have any neighbors at all.
Well, yes, our nearest neighbor is 4 kilometers to the east and 6 kilometers to the west, and they're great neighbors. We like them a lot, but, you know, we kept looking at houses, and the real estate agent would say, no, there's no houses in the area. Then we'd get to the place, and sure enough, there'd be one across the road, and they'd say, well, they're a wonderful older couple, and we said, well, that's wonderful for now until they sell the house to a biker gang. So, yeah, we really liked the idea of being away from it and not having the sort of tension that can sometimes have with neighbors and knowing we were going to probably put up a wind turbine and PV, et cetera. So I think that worked well for us, and we really do relish the peace and quiet.
Cam, one key point you make is that we need a way to make money when we get there. When I went homesteading in 1976, unemployment was around 20% in that country. Most jobs went to family members of the original residents. It was tough going for the first 3 years. Of course, there was no internet for online work. Do we need portable jobs before we go, or should some people just take the plunge with the skills they have?
Oh, no question. I think they should take the plunge, and I think the right attitude to get out and make contacts in any community will over time help you earn an income. I think that as much as I like to call myself a Luddite and had fantasies about wearing Birkenstocks and eating granola and playing Neil Young songs, the reality is that I couldn't live where I live the way I live without technology, whether it's in my photovoltaic panels or my inverter or my high-tech phone system or my satellite dish for television, my satellite dish for high-speed internet. These are all amazing technologies, and one of the things that helped us was the fact that we were in an electronic publishing business, and traffic was getting so bad in the greater Toronto area, our customers were used to not seeing us anyway. So whether we were in the same city or 3 hours away, it didn't matter as long as the work got done. So we had another number of technological challenges to overcome in terms of internet, et cetera, but once we got them solved, technology has been amazing for us. And, you know, it's allowed me to have the sort of flexibility where, you know, right now we are doing some market gardening. It's June and it's extremely hot, so I can sort of get up at 6 in the morning, work in the garden until 9 or 10 when it's starting to get uncomfortably hot, and come into the office for 6 or 7 hours. Work on my computer, have a source of income that way, and then when it cools off, get back into the garden later in the day. So, as much as I often find technology very frustrating, it has been a godsend for us.
Do you have electricity lines running into your house?
We do not. The electricity line ends 3 kilometers to the east and 5 miles to the west. When the previous owners checked about 20 years ago, they were about $100,000 from the nearest utility pole. I would say now with the way electricity rates have gone in the province of Ontario, I'm probably closer to $200,000 away from having electricity lines brought to my house. So in that instance, it's an easy decision to go off-grid. But I think that what's happened now with technology and people's comfort zone with photovoltaics and a lot of this renewable energy is that people don't have to be such a great distance. I routinely do workshops, and you know, often people are one electricity pole or two electricity poles away from the grid, but they're still thinking, gee, do I necessarily want to tie in? And the reality is rates are going up, and in a province of like Ontario, which heavily invested in nuclear power and never really paid for it, and now on everybody's electricity bill has what's called the debt retirement charge, where we're now starting to pay off all those nuclear plants we built back in the 70s. You know, people ask me, if the electricity line went by your house, would you tap into it? And I say, no, I'm quite happy to not to have to pay my share of the debt, even though I feel like I sort of should. I don't feel too bad about it.
I am really interested in your energy system, partly because I think most of us could install this low-carbon tech right here in the city as well. How much solar power do you have, and how do you use it?
We have about 2.5 kilowatts, so 2,500 watts worth of photovoltaics, and we have a 1-kilowatt Berge wind turbine. When we first moved off the grid, we had about 500 watts worth of PV, and at that time you paid about $10 a watt for photovoltaic systems. Now in the province of Ontario, we're paying about $2 a watt. So the prices have dropped dramatically, which is pretty fabulous. You know, the biggest mistake we probably made was not investing in more photovoltaics right off the bat. The average family in North America, depending on how you cook, is probably using 35 or 45 kilowatt hours of electricity a day. And when we first moved off the grid, we were down to about 5 kilowatt hours. You know, it was through very aggressive energy efficiency, et cetera. What we found over time is we've continued to upgrade our system, and as we've done that, we've been able to reduce our carbon footprint. Because most people who move off-grid sort of cheat, and they move on to propane. So they shift all their major loads, their heat loads, onto propane, which is still a fossil fuel. And we didn't want to do that. So what we've been able to do as we've increased the number of solar panels we have is to slowly wind down how much propane we use. So essentially right now, you know, we are cooking with a convection toaster oven, we have an electric kettle, electric toaster, we have an induction stovetop, we have a microwave, we have a waffle iron. So, you know, we're using electricity more and more for cooking. And the other thing people forget is that even though photovoltaics are cool and lots of people want to put them on the roof, you know, the first solar panel that goes on your roof should be to heat your hot water. That's going to give you the fastest return on investment. So we have a solar panel on our back porch from a company called Enerworks. It's called a solar domestic hot water heater, so it heats all the water that we use for washing and laundry and dishes, etc. And that system probably was $5,000 to $6,000. It's going to pay for itself in 5 to 6 years, depending on what happens with the fuel price that you're using to heat your hot water. You know, but the reality is if it pays for itself in 5 years, that's a 20% return on investment. And people need to realize that right now the bank is paying them 2% on their money. So the reality today is that renewable energy technology actually offers you a much better return on investment with your money than literally anything else in the market. And so our solar domestic hot water heater basically gets us about, we'll say, 60% of our hot water, which we don't need propane for. And then we also, when we have days like today where it's very sunny and I have excess electricity, if I was on the electricity grid, I would be dumping that into the grid and getting paid for it. But I, because the grid isn't here, I'm actually dumping it into another hot water tank. So I end up with three large hot water tanks that are heated by the sun. So even if I go into a week of cloud, I've still got enough hot water banked that I'm not going to have my propane come on.
Well, let's talk solar in winter. Will your hot water heater work in the winter time? And what happens when your solar panels get covered by snow?
Well, we're lucky enough that the panels are on trackers and we can reach them with the brooms that we've made. For people who have them, say, on a high roof where they're not accessible, the nice thing about them is that they're dark and they tend to be on enough of an angle in the winter that the snow, once the sun gets out and they warm up around the corners, the edges sort of start creeping in and the snow will come off it quite quickly. In my case, because I'm obsessive about energy, I'm out there before the sun comes up making sure the snow gets off it. Certainly in winter, in terms of production, we get a lot less, both photovoltaic electricity and hot water. From an electricity standpoint, our wind turbine is helpful because in the months with the least amount of sun, November, December, January, those tend to have the most amount of wind. So a good hybrid off-grid system will have both solar and wind. in terms of hot water, William Kemp, whose book I published, The Renewable Energy Handbook, what Bill has done and talks about in the latest draft of that book is he's taken his house off-grid, and he's been off-grid for 20 years, but he's also taken it off propane. So what he's done is he's switched his cooking to a wood cook stove, and he also has a loop through his wood stove that heats his house. And, you know, it's not feasible for a lot of people in the city, but somebody who has access to firewood, you know, firewood is a zero-carbon way to heat. That tree is absorbing carbon dioxide as it grows. When it dies and falls on the forest floor, it's going to give out the same amount of CO2 and same amount of heat as if you use it in a cook stove or a wood stove to heat your house. So in Bill's case, he's actually getting all his hot water with a loop that runs through his wood stove in those colder, darker months. Michelle and I at our house haven't done that yet, but what we do is we do heat with wood as well, and during the winter we always have four large corn pots on it. That water heats up all day, and we throw that in the bathtub at night and have a scalding hot bath. And, you know, it's nice because that water is letting off humidity into the air. And then if it's a really dark time, lots of people who live off-grid will just, when their batteries get low, will run a generator. Water is one of my biggest uses in the country, so what I do is after we've had the bath, we just leave the water in, and the next day we just take a bucket, and I use that bucket for flushing the toilet. The water, in our case, is going to end up in the same place. I'm just getting now another use from it and making sure that it's used as efficiently as possible.
Well, we did cook with wood heat and with a wood cook stove, and it was great in the winter and in the summertime. But what a lot of the older families would do is they'd have a summer kitchen, which was just basically a wood cook stove outside so that you didn't get too hot inside. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith here with homesteader and publisher Cam Mather. We've been talking about renewable energy. We should mention, as you did, one of your best-selling books. Tell us just a little bit about the Renewable Energy Handbook.
Well, when Michelle and I moved off the electricity grid, there really was no good information out there. Certainly electricians, et cetera, weren't comfortable with it. There was an outdated book on photovoltaics, and Paul Geip had a book on wind, but there was nothing that tied it all together. And we had met Bill, we'd got some used batteries from him, and he's an engineer who is very enthused about renewable energy, but is one of those rare engineers who can describe the information in a way people get it. So what we convinced Bill to do is to write a book. We had been publishing a magazine, and Bill had been writing for us. We just convinced him to do the book. And the book, what it was able to do is to focus on all areas of off-grid living. So first on energy efficiency, and it's most appropriate to anybody who lives on-grid as well, energy efficiency to get your demand down, and then solar heat for hot water, photovoltaics, it talks about wind energy, and then it talks about batteries and inverter and tying the whole system together. So I think that, you know, a lot of people buy it because it's their dream to move out to the country and live independently, but it's very appropriate in this day and age for anybody who lives in an urban environment because the technologies work the same. And in the latest draft of the Renewable Energy Handbook, you know, we talk about ground source heat pumps. You know, people want to put solar panels on to do something good for the environment, but they forget that probably in northern climates, you know, the northern U.S. and Canada, almost 70% of your energy loads are going to go to heat your home and to heat your hot water. So technically what you should be doing first is looking at a ground source heat pump or a geothermal system for heating. You know, you're still going to need some electricity, but for every unit of electricity you put into that ground source heat pump, you're then getting 3 units of heat energy out in the winter and 3 units of cool energy out in the summer. So it works. The beauty of it is it works in reverse in the summer. So, you know, a ground source heat pump doesn't sound as sexy as solar panels, but the reality is from, you know, reducing your impact on the environment, it's a much better way to invest your money.
Cam Mather, let's move on a bit to food production. What are you growing?
Well, we grow a lot of what we eat in terms of things like potatoes and, you know, onions. We have 10,000 bulbs of garlic in this year. We sell that. Our garden is getting much larger in terms of our berry production, strawberries and raspberries and blueberries now, high bush blueberries. We're excited because we've been able to add a freezer to our off-grid system, and that's really helped with freezing a lot of the things, not just the berries, but, you know, broccolis and cauliflowers. And, you know, and our favorite thing to do is at the end of the season when we have more tomatoes than we can use, Michelle's freezing them like crazy. You know, there's nothing nicer on a cold winter day than throwing a bunch of tomatoes on the wood stove in a big pot with garlic and onions out of the garden and some basil that she freezes. And, you know, by lunchtime you have this wonderful taste of summer on the coldest day. I've also experimented with a lot of things like wheat and oats. Because, you know, we have a fairly much a plant-based diet, so I've been, you know, interested to see how much of my actual food I can grow myself. And we're probably gardening on about half an acre here. And I would say that, you know, if I was aggressive about it, I could probably get 30 to 40% right now of my own food that I could grow. You know, I don't eat like a hermit in that, you know, we still have a pineapple once in a while, and people would fault me for that. But, you know, I guess the theory that, you know, you should keep dancing while the music is playing in terms of peak oil, et cetera, I believe that it's still nice to treat yourself once in a while. And I continue to be amazed that I can live in a northern climate and I can go to my local grocery store and for $4 buy a pineapple that's come all the way from Costa Rica. It's quite amazing, but I think the difference in my perspective, accepting the fact that we probably hit peak oil in 2006, is, as Fatih Birol, the executive director of the International Agency, says we did, is that those sorts of things that we all now sort of consider pretty standard, something that's sort of an inherent right, is really a privilege. It's really something pretty special, and chances are, as my income drops, as the world changes, I think I'm going to have it less and less, but when I can have it, I do appreciate it. And I think what we're trying to do now as well is sort of move our diet more in terms of the season. Like, we're about to hit strawberry season here in Ontario, so for 4 weeks we'll be eating strawberries till we're sick of them, and then we go on to raspberries, and then we go on to blueberries, and then we go into peaches that can be grown in the province of Ontario, and then we get into the fall, and now we're eating apples and pears. And I think that that's going to be the trend for a lot of people, that because the cost of shipping food is going to get so expensive, we're all going to return to eating much more locally. It's going to be thrust upon us, and I encourage people to eat more locally to support local farmers, but also so that you are doing this by choice rather than by circumstances of world energy demand having a negative impact on you. If you've chosen to do it, you're going to be much more happy about it. It's the same way as Michelle and I don't fly. You know, I think that as the price of energy goes up, especially, you know, liquid transportation fuels like kerosene, I think the cost of flying is going to be something that only rich people can afford. So people now who sort of assume they have a right to a vacation in Florida or Mexico every year, a lot of those people aren't going to be able to afford it. And I think in fairly short order. So our attitude has been, we know it's bad for the environment, and we know it's going to end soon, so we've sort of accepted that we don't fly anymore, and we're pretty comfortable with that.
Yes, I think we've pretty well made that decision as well, as much as we can. There is one family member we occasionally fly to visit. She's quite old and can't do it any other way. But, you know, when you're talking about traveling with the seasons, with what you eat, that's certainly how humans live for the last 8,000 years or so. We didn't have the luxury of a freezer, but we did have a really great root cellar that worked out well. We dried a lot of things. That's a good method. And we also did canning, of course, which is another great way to have it so you don't need electricity to keep your food. And I suppose, too, we stored some energy in our animals. Now, not everybody agrees with this, but we did raise chickens for both meat and for eggs. And for several years, we raised pigs, too, because in a northern climate, it's pretty tough to find food that's ready to eat in December through February. And I think that's why northern people tended to eat animals more, while southern people could be vegetarians where they could get two or three runs. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with you. And, you know, I love talking to my local organic farmer, John Wise, who I often, with his pigs that seem to have just a whale of a time. They have a huge field. He'll turn it out, and it'll be lush and green, and they'll be out there for a summer, and it'll be basically turned into mud or beautiful topsoil. And I've often commented to John on this, and he says, you know, pigs used to be considered the poor man's plow. You could just put a pigs in an area, and they will be happy rooting around and first eating the green stuff off and then digging everything up by the roots, and next year you can have a wonderful garden there. And I think that Michelle and I sort of accept that, too. We still eat eggs, and in the last couple of months we've acquired some chickens, which just adore. They're incredibly entertaining. And when Michelle has learned more and more about factory farming with chickens and layers being in cages where essentially they have about the room of an 8x10 sheet of paper, and there's six or eight of them in one of these cages, Michelle just said, I won't eat eggs if I know the chicken has been treated that inhumanely. And so we've built a coop for them, and they have as much room as they want to run around, and they're treated like princesses here, and Michelle's pretty comfortable eating their eggs now. So, yeah, I think from a sustainability standpoint as well, as I look at growing on a very sandy soil, I have a neighbor who has horses, and She has no use for her horse manure, so it's essential for me in terms of supplementing my soil, and I think livestock can have a very important role in sustainable agriculture. I think where things have got out of whack is when you put 10,000 cows in one spot and you have huge problems of manure and E. coli getting into water supplies, etc. I mean, that's problematic, but in my area, I've got lots of beef farmers. They don't have the money for feedlots. The cows are out on pasture, and the manure is used and spread on hay fields quite sustainably and I think quite safely, and I think that these are definitely going to be things that we have to consider in the future, just doing it on a smaller, more humane scale.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Cam Mather. Cam, less talked about are the personal adjustments that have to be made by family members. I gather you and your wife moved with two young daughters. How has it worked out for the women of the family?
Well, I was fortunate that Michelle was very much on board with getting out of the city. We are just finishing up our book on our experience right now called The Little House Off the Grid, and, you know, Michelle's being very honest about it. You know, it takes a little getting used to any move to the country in terms of not having the convenience of stores conveniently close to your home. Any time that we need supplies, it's sort of a big deal. We'll go down every 2 or 3 weeks to the city and sort of be gone for most of the day to make sure we make as many stops as we can. When we moved here, our daughters were, before their early teens, and we were, by choice, the girls were being homeschooled. They'd sort of had enough of public school, and they loved the move to the country. I mean, we've got a pond on the property. We did get a satellite dish, so they could watch much music, and they were sort of plugged into the real world that way, as well as with the internet. But, you know, as soon as they hit high school, they wanted to be with kids their own age, and off they went on the school bus. So, you know, both my daughters now live in the city of Toronto, 3 hours away. And they have jobs there. One comes home less often than the other because she loves city life, and the younger one, Katie, she comes home a little bit more. She loves to take photos, and there's no shortage of beautiful things in our area to take pictures of. But I think over time they will probably enjoy coming back here more and more to the peace and quiet rather than the excitement of a big city. And I'm fortunate in that Michelle has been patient because, unlike somebody who would introduce renewable energy into their home today where the technology is well established and basically will all run in background, you won't even be aware of it of functioning. It'll just be another appliance in your house. You know, there were some real learning curves that we went through, and basically we've upgraded every system in our house from, you know, appliances, fridges, washing machines, etc., to inverters and everything else that's sort of in phone systems, and everything that most people take for granted has sort of been a challenge for us. But Michelle is a very patient woman, and she's taken it all in stride. And now that the system is working very well, it's a real luxury. You know, it's a luxury to use an electric toaster. You know, when we moved off the grid, I was convinced that we would never have enough power to use a real toaster. But Bill Kemp, through learning through the Renewable Energy Handbook, has sort of taught me that, yes, a toaster uses a lot of power when it's on, but it doesn't use a lot of energy because it's only on for 2 or 3 minutes. So once you sort of start getting comfortable with these concepts, you realize that you can have any luxury a North American can have. You just have to realize that at a certain point, electricity is limitless. We understand that that electricity has ramifications when it's produced, and so we use it very wisely.
Our guest is Cam Mather, homesteader and publisher of how-to and sustainable energy books at aztext.com. Cam, one of your books is Thriving Through Challenging Times. That's a topic we all want to know about. Can you give us a short thumbnail of that book?
Well, I really just sort of took a look at the converging challenges of climate change and the economic collapse and peak oil. And I think given any one of these things alone, I think that governments, if they had sort of launched a World War II cooperative effort to tackle just climate change or just some of these other things on their own, might work. But I think because they're all going to be happening simultaneously, I believe that we won't be able to expect as much from government, and I think that we need to get a little bit more independent-minded. So I simply go through all the areas of people's lives in terms of where they get their energy, where they get their food, and how they earn their income, and say, you know, it's time to take a look at those elements of your life. You know, I've had somebody who took my workshop who worked for a large grocery store chain, and he said, you know, I bring 20 trucks a week into Canada with produce from California and Florida. And I think he sort of realized that that may not be a long-term good career for him, and he was quite excited because he wasn't happy in his job, and he said, you know, I'm going to start looking around and find a job that makes more sense in a post-peak oil world. The book just goes through each element of your life, how you heat your home, how you power your home, where you get your food, how you earn your income, and says, here are some ideas on things that you may want to start thinking about that are going to make you more resilient to some of the shocks that I think the system is experiencing now, whether it's economic collapse or, $140 a barrel oil, or the climate change with all the people that have been killed in the States with tornadoes, and, you know, you've got a drought going on in Texas and flooding in Mississippi. I think these things are all going to make for some tough times ahead, and I don't see why people need to be shocked. I mean, the classic story is Bill Kemp during the ice storm here when, you know, you had millions of people in Canada and northern U.S. without electricity, some of them for weeks. Eventually in Canada, the military is called out because, you know, people are in dire straits. They don't have electricity. They can't heat their home. Their furnace fan won't work. They can't wash. They can't cook. You know, they get to Bill Kemp's house. The door opens. Heat wafts out. Because Bill heats with wood, Bill's in a bathrobe because he just had a shower, he's got music playing on the radio, he's got a steaming cup of coffee, and the military people say, well, we think we know the answer, but is everybody in the house okay? And Bill says, it's never been better. You know, the technology exists for you to be entirely independent. You don't have to earn an income and trade up all your independence to somebody in a city who's going to heat your home and power your home and grow your food. You can do it yourself, but we've chosen to trade those things away. And the reality is three generations ago, if there'd been an ice storm where I live, you know, a farmer might have spilled some milk on the way back from the farm, but his house would still be warm, his pump would still work, he could kill a pig for dinner, and he'd have a root cellar full of vegetables to eat. Whereas now, when we have these shocks, people are in dire straits. They can't eat. They can't keep their home warm. They can't wash. They can't do basic things because they've traded that independence away. And everything I talk about in the book, whether it's growing your own food or making your own energy, I just say when I've done it, it's just had a wonderful effect. It's been tremendously gratifying, and it gives me great joy. So I think it's the cool thing to do. I think that people that actually pursue this will find that their life starts taking on more meaning. And everything that you do and everything I talk about in Thriving During Challenging Times reduces your impact on the planet. That's the beauty of it. There's no downside to any of the things I suggest, whether it's growing your own food or joining a CSA or putting up solar panels or putting in a ground source heat pump. All these things make you more resilient to shocks, but they significantly reduce your impact on the planet. So it's win-win, and you feel great about it. So I think it's a very upbeat book.
And how can people keep track of what you're doing and find out more about your books?
The books are available at aztext.com, aztext.com. Or you can follow me at cammather.com. That's my website. And my blog is also available on the Mother Earth News website. And, yeah, I sort of keep people up to date on what's going on in my life and challenges that I'm facing. And I sense from the feedback that we get through the blogs that I think a lot of people that work in cities and sit at computers can live sort of vicariously through it. I remind people often in my blogs that I have certainly reduced my income in terms of the choice that I've made to live where I do, but that becomes less and less important to me as I take more and more joy in doing some of the simple things that I do on a daily basis.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Cam Mather. He took his family out of city life and into a remote homestead in Canada. They slashed their burden on nature and the atmosphere without giving up a modern, comfortable life. Cam publishes a list of really tasty-looking how-to books on food production, home energy projects, and finding new meaning in a life that you do enjoy living. Cam, I've really enjoyed talking with you.
I have, too. It's been great. Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock and for Earthbeat.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.